Welcome to this audio tour by the Paston Footprints National Heritage Lottery funded project, a collaboration between the School of Literature at the University of East Anglia, the Paston Heritage Society, Collisions Theatre and Norfolk County Council. A map can be downloaded via the phone app or at pastonfootprints.co.uk. At each stopping point on the walk, press play and listen for a couple of minutes as the voices from the Paston letters are animated into life. The Motby Walk is narrated by Anne Paston. Born in 1455, she lived until the end of the 15th century.
Hello, fellow travellers. I'm Anne, daughter of John Paston I and Margaret Motby Paston. I am the fifth of seven children, and unfortunate for me, one that you may not have heard of. However, I am proud to be a member of the Paston family. Many of the 15th to 17th century members may be known to you, as I believe our Paston clan is considered one of the most dynamic families in East Anglian history. Oh, there are so many stories to tell. But it is Margaret Paston whose story we're focusing on today. Follow me as I bring medieval Motby to life, focusing on the words and life of my mother, Margaret Motby Paston. And I can't resist sharing some gossip and other troubles which occurred within the family during my lifetime, including all the to-do surrounding my father's inheritance of Caister Castle. As my mother Margaret would say,
"While the world is as it is, you can never live in peace."
Perhaps that is why religion plays such a large role in our lives in the 15th century. If you get a chance to check out my brother's great book, now a manuscript in the British Library, Lounsdown 285, you'll see the range of devotional poems and plays we read. If we can't be sure of peace on earth, we passionately believe that a greater life is in store for us in heaven. This church, the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul, was important to my mother's family, and it holds the bones of many of my ancestors. But the church isn't just a place for the dead. It's a vibrant sanctuary for the living and a place of hope for those who are ill or in trouble. Ah, if I close my eyes, I hear again the sounds of the church. In the 15th century, the church is the centre of life in Motby. We come together here weekly to praise our blessings in life, to pray for a better harvest, or for our dearly departed relative souls. The church provides a strong sense of community and belonging. The sermons, though, are in Latin, so most of us love to have things to look at if we lose track of what is being said. That's why there are monuments and stained glass windows, embroideries and church wall paintings in the medieval Norfolk churches. When you go into the church, imagine such a visual feast. Inside, there's one key example to look out for. A tomb with a dog at the foot of a knight, which is a Knight Templar's grave, and it is quite possibly that of my ancestor, Sir Walter de Motby, buried in 1248. The dog at his feet is a symbol of loyalty, a friend who leads him to the other world. I will wait here for you to explore the church. Press pause, and then rejoin me at the plaque for Margaret Paston, which you will find in the churchyard. This plaque was installed for my mother, Margaret Paston, long into the future, in 2019 to be precise. The exact place of her grave is long lost, unfortunately. But I am proud to say that my mother's memory lasts well beyond her lifetime. She was very fond of Motby, and as Caister Castle was too cold and draughty, came back to live in her childhood home at the end of her life. She desired to be buried alongside her family members at Motby. Standing here, I can remember one of her letters as if she is speaking in front of me this instant.
"I commit my soul to Almighty God and to Our Lady, His Blessed Mother, Saint Michael, Saint John the Baptist, and to all saints, and my body to be buried in the aisle of Motby Church, in front of the image of Our Lady there, in which aisle rest the bodies of various of my ancestors, whose souls may God absolve."
My mother was a formidable woman, a real matriarch. Born just down the road in Motby Hall, she went on to marry an up-and-coming Norfolk landowner and lawyer, John Paston. Over 100 of Margaret's letters were found in the early 18th century by an antiquarian called Bloomfield over in Oxnead. You can view them via the link on the website pastonfootprints.com. She not only wrote letters, but also collected ours, her children's, and her grandchildren's. Our Paston scribbles make up the largest and earliest collection of family letters in the world. But it's particularly my mother's letters that have the ability to change how you might view the late Middle Ages. It isn't just a time of great battles and political intrigue, but also the small-scale cares and worries of a real and everyday family. Perhaps something you might relate to. This is why I can proudly say she holds in the 21st century the accolade of First Woman of Letters, as you see on this memorial plaque. Right here in 15th century Mortby, we have a celebrity! But we better be moving on! You'll want to follow the road to the first bend and keep straight along the footpath. The map will help guide you to Pickerill Holm Dyke, the second stop on our tour. En route, look at the small farms surrounding this area. Maybe you can glimpse a De Mortby sheep or two grazing in the nearby fields. Press pause and I will join you there. Happy walking! Did you find that walk pretty, or even tranquil? For people in my time, our fields are a blessing, but are also places of work, hard, back-breaking toil. There have been many men like my great-grandfather Clement Paston, who lived life as a good, plain husbandman, working the plough, minding their small farms, and paying rent to the great landowners of Norfolk. But times change. Believe it or not, these fields are testimony that some good can come out of a pandemic. The Black Death, so prevalent in the 14th and 15th centuries, benefited all those in areas like Mortby. If you have any children, they might want to explore the Black Death activity sheets you can find on the phone app. But back to my story. Though the plague decimated the population, for the survivors, opportunities abounded. Most of the men who till the soil and pay rents on our Paston and Mortby lands of the 15th century are now free men and no longer serfs as they had been in the past. Some follow in my great-grandfather's footsteps, rising in status and power and potentially owning estates of their own. This is how my grandfather was able to become a judge and send his son, my father, to Cambridge University. Better wages and the opportunity to save and buy land is changing the country. My family live with and represent the tenants surrounding these lands. Estate management isn't just the domain of the menfolk. Margaret Paston often took care to see that the tenants were not neglected. Due to all this multitasking, she created a new word to describe her formidable management skills as a woman. Captainess. Just listen to her captainess strategizing.
If it please you, I should like the marsh that Brig had to be kept in your own hand this year, so that the tenants might have rushes to repair their houses with. And also there is windfall wood at the manor that is of no great value, that might help them towards their own repairs, if you like to let those that are in most need have it.
So, what about my mother's side of the family? The De Mortbys were of higher status than the Pastons, an ancient family who united with another ancient family, the Burneys. These two families owned much of the land in the district. As the sole heiress, Margaret's father died when she was only 11 or 12 years old, my mother brought the Pastons a dowry of £150 a year from her estates, including this one. But even though it was an arranged marriage, brought together by a close relationship between Judge William Paston and Margaret's father, their meeting was a favourable one. My grandmother Agnes wrote to her husband about my parents' first encounter.
As for the first acquaintance between John Paston and the said gentlewoman, she made him gentle cheer in gentle wise, and said he was verily your son. And so I hope there shall need no great treaty between them.
The marriage proved a long and successful one, filled with affection and loyalty between them. Sadly, my father was away from home often. As a lawyer, John I spent so much time in London and abroad tending to family business, fighting wars, and to his own legal battles over Paston property rights. My favourite of my mother's letters is her writing to my father, wishing him home on one of his many absences.
If I might have had my will, I should have seen you before this time. I would you were at home liefer than a new gown, though it was scarlet.
And between you and I, that is not a small sacrifice on my mother's part. She loved her scarlet gowns and girdles. But before you get the wrong impression, Margaret proved to be much more than a wife or a lover of pretty clothes. She was an ally to my father, and more than capable of dealing with the many troubles the Paston family had in Norfolk.
Most honourable husband, I commend myself to you. May it please you to know that I have spoken to several of your tenants at Drayton this week, and encouraged them that everything will be well from now on. Next week I intend to go to Helsden, and send our men out to collect money at Drayton and Helsden. If you want, I will have a manorial court held at Drayton before I leave there. We shall do the best we can, and send word of how we get on.
My parents were married in a difficult time of Norfolk history. Instability abroad meant instability at home. The battles with the French became battles for the crown, and many rivaling families fought each other for control of land and estates all across the country. Like my father in London, my mother in Norfolk had to fight to protect Paston land and learn to negotiate protection of the Pastons' rights in the country.
I am reliably informed that the Duke of Suffolk is building up a large force in both Norfolk and Suffolk to come down with him and drive us back if they can. Therefore, I want you to use any means to make yourself as secure as you can in the place, because I and many others believe that if they do not find you here, they will look for you where you are.
What with the pirates off the coast, robbers on the roads, and powerful men such as the Duke of Suffolk and Lord Moylands attacking our purse, our land, our servants, and ourselves, we had much to be afraid of. But be brave and journey on. Press pause, and I will meet you at Clink Hill, where you can get a better viewing of Caister Castle and the road to Yarmouth. You can see how close Caister Castle is from here. One of the troubles about possession of Caister was not only its importance to the Pastons as a prestigious property for my ambitious and strong-willed family, but also its importance to the surrounding area, and indeed Mortby. As my mother wrote in a letter to my elder brother, John II,
"It is said secretly by those who are at Caister that I am likely to have little good from Mortby, if the Duke of Norfolk still has possession of Caister. And if we lose that, we lose the fairest flower in our garland."
It's quite a saga how we came to own Caister Castle. It all started with a relative of my mother's, Sir John Falstaff. Yes, he was the inspiration for Shakespeare's Falstaff, though Shakespeare used quite a lot of poetic license, and the real Sir John was much more formidable than the one penned by the bard. Sir Falstaff was a Knight of the Garter, and his great success in the wars in France with the warrior king Henry V made him a very wealthy man indeed. Falstaff amassed over 80 estates in Norfolk and Suffolk. My father, John Paston I, was a close friend of Sir John Falstaff, and his legal adviser for many years. As the knight was childless, on his deathbed in 1459 he made a will in favour of John Paston.
Being in my master Fastolf's chamber, heard my said master and John Paston conclude that after his decease, John Paston should cause to be founded a college at Caister of 7 monks or priests, and that John Paston should have all the live load that was of my said master in Norfolk and Suffolk to him and his heirs in freehold ownership. This is the deposition of Robert Fitzralph, Esquire, 26 November 1459.
My mother quickly moved into two of Falstaff's estates, Helsden and Caister, but it didn't take long for a storm of troubles to arise. There are rival claimants in Suffolk and in Norfolk, and the disputes have become more and more aggressive by the day. The Duke of Suffolk's men soon were encroaching upon our land at Drayton with his false claims of ownership and attacking our tenants at Helsden.
The Duke of Suffolk's servant brought a bailiff and let us plainly know that if you or any other of your servants took any distress at Drayton, even for the value of a hen, they would come to Helsden and take it for the value of an ox. and if they are prevented from doing so, then they will go into any live load that you have in Norfolk or Suffolk and take a distress, just as they would at Helston.
My poor father. He would deal with litigation over Falstaff's estates for the rest of his life. He died in 1466, with a grand funeral procession carrying his body to be interred at Bromholm Abbey. With the torchbearers, the masses said for his soul, and the alms given out to the poor, it was a funeral worthy of his true position in the county. However, the dust hardly settled, unfortunately, when my brothers, John II and John the Younger, took up the fight over the Falstaff estates. This time, the attack was not from the Duke of Suffolk, but the Duke of Norfolk. So, let's move on to our next stop on the walk. Press pause, and I'll join you at a magnificent view of Caister Castle, where I can share with you the story of the Battle of Caister. We are now looking at Caister Castle, of continental design, one of the first buildings in the county to be built of brick. The Great Tower was built to provide a view towards Yarmouth and possible attacks from the French. We greatly fear an invasion from the sea with the long years of war with France. However, we have had much more bother from local landlords, especially the Duke of Norfolk. As it is now 1467, my mother has just moved to her house in Norwich, and my brother, John the Younger, is now in residence in Caister Castle, ready to defend it from rival claimants, and build more defences in case of attack. Yet our older brother, John II, remains in London. Yes, I have two brothers called John. It is a bit confusing, really. It is quite frustrating for my younger brother here in Norfolk, trying to protect the Paston estates while our older brother is more occupied with his position at court, his courtly tournaments and pursuit of jousting, not to mention his mistresses, rather than protecting his land at home.
Sir, whereas it pleases you to wish that I had been at Eltham at a tourney, because of the spectacle that was there, but by my troth, I had rather see you once in Caister Hall than see as many king's tourneys as might be between Eltham and London.
There is little help for us provided by Sir John II, and in spite of Margaret's pleading and John the Younger's urging, the storm continues to rise without any sign of it being abated.
I marvel greatly that you send me no word how you do, for your enemies begin to grow right bold, and that puts your friends in fear and doubt. Therefore arrange that they may have some comfort, so that they be not discouraged, for if we lose our friends, it will be hard in this troublous world to get them back.
Soon enough, the battle for Caister Castle was upon us. It is rumoured that the Duke of Norfolk has 4,000 men. God save us, for we have only 30. Oh, I hear them coming. Take cover, quick!
Mother, we stand in great jeopardy at Caister. Two are dead, and others badly hurt, and gunpowder and arrows are lacking. The place is badly broken down by the guns of the other party, so that unless they have hasty help, they are likely to lose both their lives and the place.
What a cruel day, with guns fired at the castle. My mother writes in haste to Sir John about the plight of his brother and all at Caister.
I greet you well, letting you know that your brother and his fellowship stand in great jeopardy at Caister and lack victual. And the place is sore broken by the guns of the other party, so that, unless they have hasty help, they are like to lose both their lives and the place to the greatest rebuke to you that ever came to any gentleman. For every man in this country marvels greatly that you suffer them to be so long in such great jeopardy without help or other remedy.
So, despite our pleas, John the Elder denies that there is any battle. It is little wonder we are lost with such jeopardy before us and without help or other remedy from the head of the household, John II. My younger brother John breaks the dreadful news in a letter.
We were forced to surrender Caister Castle. We were sore lacking in victuals, gunpowder, and men's hearts, and lack of certainty of rescue drove us to the treaty. If my brother had not been hasty, the Duke of Norfolk's wife would tire of the whole affair and the king would grant our claim. But my brother was hasty and brought this battle and bloodshed upon us.
It was a sad day when we lost Caister Castle. It would take many years before we managed to regain it from the Duke of Norfolk's widow. Then we had to sell it in the 17th century due to waning funds. Let us move from this place. Follow the trail to meet me at the site of my mother's house, and I'll tell you about another battle of the Pastons. But this one is of just plain stubbornness. Press pause and continue following the map to Mortby Hall. Here we are looking at the grounds of Mortby Hall, which unfortunately is no longer standing. Besides the remains of Caister Castle you just left, and a few remnants at Gresham, none of my family's great houses remain, though some have been reconstructed in 3D on the Footprints website. In my time, many houses were still built of wood, not yet of brick or stone, but you must not think we lived in a simple fashion. Imagine a 15th century hall with elegant tapestries and fine linen and wooden carvings. Set in a courtyard with a garden, Mortby had its own chapel, a great chamber, and a chapel chamber. 15th century houses were moving from the original medieval-style hall made up of one large room to become grander and more comfortable residences worthy of gentlemen. However, for me, it's less the buildings and more the family gossip I remember. Mortby was also a site of some of the family squabbles of my siblings. When he became a young man, my brother John the Elder had a rather strained relationship with my father. He was often in debt and was not as steady as John the Younger.
To my dearly beloved son, Sir John Paston, you did not conduct yourself well in leaving here without my knowledge. Therefore, I am letting you know I was very displeased with you. Your father thought, and still thinks, that I had agreed to your leaving, and that has made me very sad. I believe he will be a good father to you from now on, if you conduct yourself well and do as you ought towards him.
Sir John, however, very rarely conducted himself well. My father refused to let him enter his house after one breach for over a year. Mother tried to be the mediator and reconciler.
I understand that you do not wish your son to be received into your house, nor to be helped by you until the same time of the year he was put out of it last year. For God's sake, sir, have pity on him. And remember, it has been a long time since he had anything from you to help him. I believe he will be more aware of his own failings from now on.
Regrettably, the relationship between my father, John I, and my brother, Sir John Paston II, remained cool for the rest of my father's life. Though my eldest brother could be difficult to live with and did not manage the estates as well as his younger brother would prove to do, there was still much love and affection between my two brothers, and we were very sorry to hear of his death in 1479. John II, along with my brother Walter and my grandmother Agnes, all died of one of the many outbreaks of the plague that we lived through. God rest their souls.
Right, worshipful mother, the bearer hereof can tell you the more pity is, if it pleased God, that my brother is buried in the White Friars at London, which I thought should not have been, for I supposed he would have been buried at Bromham. I have ridden all the way to have brought home my grandam and him together, but that purpose is void now. Also, please it you to understand that whereas you willed me to haste out of the air I am in, it is so that I must put me in God, for here must I be for a season. And in good faith, I shall never, while God sendeth me life, dread more death than shame. And thanked be to God, the sickness is well ceased here, and also my business putteth away my fear.
Let us leave this place. Press pause and rejoin me where we began, in front of my mother's memorial plaque at the church. I hope you enjoyed our tour of Margaret Paston's Mortby, and some of the Paston dramas along the way. John the Younger proved to be a more steady hand at business and caring for the Paston lands than his brother or even his father had done, and all the later Pastons of the letters were from his descendants. My mother Margaret, my brother John III, and his wife Marjorie Bruce were all able to regain Caister Castle and become one of the most important families in Norfolk for the next 250 years. There are many other stories to be told.
Visit pastonfootprints.co.uk for creative activities for children and adults to do after the walk, or to discover further Paston walks and audio tours, with each place telling a different chapter of the Paston story, including Paston Village, Bacton, Blowfield, Oxnead, Gresham, Norwich, and cycle routes at Mannington and Flegg.